Hello, and welcome to the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. This podcast provides updates based on the expertise and insights from the attorneys at the Washington, D.C.-based law firm, Fortney Scott, and their guests. This podcast will provide an analysis of significant federal developments affecting the workplace that employers need to understand and is for informational purposes only and does not provide legal advice. Now let's turn it over to our hosts, Nita Beecher.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of DC Insider. I'm Nita Beecher, sitting in for David Fortney, and I'm delighted to be joined by Kelly Wilson, Director and Principal Consultant, Workforce Equity at DCI Consulting. Kelly and I have done a number of presentations on the subject of DE&I audits, and so we're really excited to talk about the new problems that DE&I programs are having and the attacks on them and what corporations need to do about it. Kelly, thanks for joining me, and I'm looking forward to our discussion about how employers can respond to these attacks on DE&I. Can you introduce yourself? This is your first time on our podcast, to our podcast audience.
Nita, thanks so much for the invitation to speak today. I'm very excited to have this conversation on this important topic. As you mentioned, I'm the director and principal consultant at DCI Consulting in the workforce equity practice area. This is our practice area that focuses on diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility in a proactive space. And one of our biggest opportunities and challenges right now working with organizations is in the space of DEI programs and how to mitigate the risk associated with them. So I'm excited to be here today and happy to share any insights that I have on this topic.
I think first and foremost, Kelly, I'd like for you to talk a little bit at how this DE&I risk assessment came out of the Supreme Court decision in FFA versus Harvard UNC. I'm not sure that any of us thought this would be as much of a risk as it is. And I know you're working with corporations, as you mentioned, to deal with that.
Absolutely. So we do partner with higher education as well as corporations and corporate America. And one of the things that we were surprised about was the ripple effect from the Supreme Court ruling on corporate America. And so let me just back up and say that universities have, for a longstanding time, have tried to diversify their student body. And that's an important activity because that carries forward into the workforce, you know, with those degrees and that experience, they're working in the workforce today. And so one of the things that we need to think about is, what was this case about and what was the outcome? Well, one of the things that higher education was doing was they were allowed to take into account race-conscious decisions in the admission selection process. And that is no longer allowed under this census case. And so what that means is it actually levels the playing field as far as bringing higher education up in line with what employers are allowed to do under Title VII, which was to not take into consideration race, ethnicity, or sex when making selection decisions for employment. And so what we're seeing is that the ripple effect is really in the fact that certain groups and stakeholders want to understand what corporate America is doing and ensuring that they're not doing something inappropriate with their programs. Because as we said, a limelight happened on higher education and it just rippled into the corporate America space and want to ensure that they're doing everything risk averse. And so with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Nita, to talk about what has come out of the Supreme Court since that ruling in June of 2023.
Well, I think the first thing before we talk about that is to remember that in his opinion, Chief Justice Roberts mentioned that while race could no longer be taken into account, experience could. So a person's experience as a person of color in a white world, for example, could be in an essay. So with that in mind, there was a follow-up case that the Supreme Court just recently refused to hear. Fairfax County, Thomas Jefferson High School is very hard to get into. And in an attempt to avoid these race-conscious problems that have arisen, the high school had put into place the use of geography, economic factors, and student experiences as allowable race-neutral admission policies. The Fourth Circuit said that was acceptable, and the Supreme Court refused to review that. So that now is a standard that employers can use as a guide for race-neutral policies in hiring.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we want to follow is any new cases or case findings that are coming out on this topic, Because regardless if it's in the higher education or the corporation space, I think that there are important takeaways that can be lessons learned and opportunities to potentially embark and adopt those practices. And one of the things that we actually see in the educational space is that certain programs take into consideration information like wealth, education, and class differences, as well as weight information like adversity, without actually considering race or ethnicity as part of that. And so I think that there's a lot of opportunity to monitor and adopt practices as we learn more and share more across space.
I think one of the things that we need to do, though, is to understand who these people are who are coming after corporate DE&I programs, as well as, obviously, the issues within the higher education space. We have Stephen Miller's group, Stephen Miller, who was with Donald Trump in his first term, and his America First Legal. That group has filed over 30 what they are calling civil rights complaints with the EEOC, complaining about various activities on the part of major corporations such as Macy's, IBM, Starbucks, McDonald's, and the list goes on. And a lot of what they collected comes out of 10Ks and 10Qs. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit about what corporations ought to do about that. But because this is the kind of information that they want to share with shareholders. In addition, he's also filed these complaints over major organizations such as MLB and NASCAR, claiming that they have internships and scholarships that are race-based. And I think those are things that those are being investigated, we believe, by the EEOC through the use of commissioner's charges. Andrea Lucas, one of the Republican EEOC commissioners, we'll talk about her in a minute, has filed as many as 15 commissioner's charges over the last year. And we believe some of them are based on this particular area. We also had Edward Blum and his AAER group. He won the Supreme Court case in SSFA, and he is now using the Section 1981 of the Civil Rights Act of 1866 to file lawsuits against major law firms who had minority hiring internships, and they had to revise their internships so that they were broader and not race-based, more like what we saw with Thomas Jefferson. In addition, he's filed a number of lawsuits against funds that provide economic support to individuals based on race. The other thing we wanted to mention is we had a big Twitter fight with Andrea Lucas and Mark Cuban over what is legally allowed when you're hiring. And I think it's important to remember that Title VII probably only, I think most interpretations of Title VII say that you can't use race or gender to make decisions, whether it's hiring, promotion, or terminations. And you have to keep that in mind as an employer. I know that probably companies have fudged that over the years, but now you're being watched very closely. And the Republicans are coming after the EEOC. The House Republicans have asked in a letter, which is supposed to be responded to by today, what is the EEOC doing about when employers are not complying with Title VII, at least the interpretation as outlined by Andrea Lucas. But there's a very interesting case. Pfizer had, in fact, a similar internship to the ones we're talking about here based on race or ethnicity, and they were sued by an organization over that, similar to the ones we just talked about. Pfizer changed the eligibility for that particular program and was able to get that case dismissed because the people that filed it couldn't show any damages, that these people actually lost anything. And I think that's going to be something to follow as we move forward, Kelly. And with that in mind, what do you think the next thing corporations should do with all of this attacks on their programs?
Yeah, thank you for that overview of all of the different activity that has been happening. And one thing before I go into what we can do is just to remind the audience that diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are not new. They've been around for many, many years in different forms. And most selection activities or employment activities impact it formally or informally. And what's interesting is even before the Supreme Court ruling that we recently talked about on the podcast, there was the activism coming out of the George Floyd incident. And so one of the things that we saw is that employers became very ambitious and active in pledging to make change and to support racial equity. And one of the things that came out of that were some overly broad statements on how they were going to correct for that. And in some of those statements, that's where some of the scrutiny can actually come into play as to what you're actually doing to implement that change. How are you actually making that change occur through different activities? And where we want to stay away from is anything that sounds, or any activity that sounds like it could be a quota or some type of preferential hiring decision. And as we know, and as we talk about, that is an illegal activity, and we want to stay away from that type of activity as an employer. And so one of the things that we encourage now, just with all of this extra attention on corporate America, is to take a thorough review of your DEI programs and do an inventory of everything that, from communications to the data that you collect and the commitments that you make, and ensure that there's mitigated risk associated with your entire program, and making sure that your program actually produces the intended outcomes that you actually want to see with those programs.
You know, it's really interesting. You know, you're talking about DE&I now being seen as a risk factor. I think that's a new, we've seen articles in the Bloomberg Law about this being seen as a very high level of risk. And I think that's reasonable in light of these challenges that we just talked about. I do think, and I want to reinforce what you said, I think every company who has a DE&I program really needs to do a risk assessment, and they need to do it under privilege. So what are you seeing in your DE&I auditing? Because I know you've been doing that for a while.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that you mentioned was this risk factor, and some low-hanging fruit when it comes to risk for organizations are those public commitments. So pledging commitment to racial equity and how you're actually going to go about that. And one place that we see that come out is in the proxy season, as part of proxy statements for investors, as well as through 10K filings with the SEC. And so that is one area of opportunity that impacts a lot of organizations right now, and thinking through how they submit that information, what statements and commitments they're making. In a recent Bloomberg Law article that I read recently on this topic, one thing that we saw is that DEIA is a risk factor that's being listed by some of the companies reporting on this topic. And it's important to think about that risk factor as not necessarily applicable to the organization, but it could just be a risk factor to the entire economy overall. And also, it does not actually imply the stance or the commitment of the organization to DEI. It's just generally a risk. And we are seeing that in practice, that companies are concerned about how their DEI programs are being perceived, how employees are being impacted by different initiatives. But with all good intent, most organizations that we're working with want to do the right thing and want to ensure that there's benefits to not only the employer, but to the employee and future employees of the organization. And so what we are starting to see is this inquiry into, please help us to audit all of our practices.
So when you do that, let's keep it moving here and talk a little bit about what kind of an audit do you do, obviously under privilege, because that's the kind of audit you need to do.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So one of the first steps that we do is to engage external counsel. Because in its title, a DEI risk assessment is a risk assessment, and to ensure that the company is, you know, protected, we like to engage under attorney-client privilege. And so we do partner with law firms like yourself, and to keep privilege all of the conversations and information that's collected out of it. And that also helps us to understand who the audience is and the stakeholders are that's going to receive the feedback from us. And once we start the engagement, so once we have approval to move forward under that attorney-client privilege, we like to go through an inventory list or an audit of the organization's communications, their data, and all of their policies, procedures, and practices. And so we take a really holistic and comprehensive approach. We look at quantitative and qualitative approaches to gather that information, and we exhaust all venues, right? So we look at a lot of different materials to assess what is actually happening in practice. So one of the things that we'll do is create that inventory and work with our partners to collect the information so that we can go through it, review it, and identify with the help of legal where there's the most risk and attention that we need to prioritize our efforts on. And so as part of that, we will help identify high, medium, and low risk opportunities. And I'll give it back over to you, Nita, to share an example of what a high, medium, and low risk could look like.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Kelly, that's really helpful because I think it's easier to look at it when you look at the whole audit and you see the issues that you have brought up, you have to decide what you can really focus on. So looking at the lawsuits that have been filed, clearly highest risk are any of your programs, whether internships, scholarships, any of that type of stuff, or, you know, training, which is focused on a particular race or ethnicity, or even women. Women is a lower standard, but definitely of risk, but any race or ethnicity. For example, if you want, the law firms is a perfect example. The law firms had a diversity internship to bring in Black and Hispanic law students into the law firms. That is going to be very high risk. Those need to be looked at and evaluated. The second medium risk, we're now seeing a run-up on what we call the Rooney Rule or diverse slates. I think that's the next area to look at and decide exactly how that should be handled. And tying executive compensation to meeting certain DE&I metrics. And I know, Kelly, you have some ideas about how can you tie executive compensation to DE&I without running into problems.
One of the unique things about partnering with industrial organizational psychologists like myself and the team that works closely with me is that we study employee behavior in the workplace and help overcome those barriers with evidence-based practices. And this is a common question, and it is a competitive advantage for a lot of organizations, and it's hard to understand each organization's approach to paying to their total rewards programs. But when it comes to tying compensation to executive outcomes, is we like to focus on efforts-based outcomes. And remember back to the space that it's illegal to set quotas, set-asides, or have preferential treatment. Same goes here. We want to avoid any linkages to that type of activity. And so the best path forward typically is to compensate on the actual efforts that were put forth. And so things like creating an action-oriented program of efforts, where do you want to align your budgets to support those efforts, making sure you assign responsibility and oversight and some type of monitoring of that effort and ensure that that effort was effective in some way that benefits the organization, not just from a headcount perspective. And so that's one of the tips that we can leave you with without giving away the secret sauce of many organizations.
Well, and I think the low risk one is one that I think people don't understand. Outreach and recruitment to minorities and women where you have underutilization is not covered by Title VII. You're allowed to do as much of that as you want. But let's go back to what you just said, Kelly. If you're going to do outreach and recruitment, you need to make sure that it's actually effective. Because I think out of all of this, what you want to do is come up with a DE&I plan that works, that brings in people that you can actually hire. And I think that's where we need to go when it's all said and done.
Absolutely. I think it's very clear that outreach and recruitment is a large opportunity for many organizations to attract diverse talent pool without crossing the lines of any legal standards or mandate. So looking at the retention efforts and monitoring how you actually retain your talent is another important area. And that's something that we also see in the higher education space. And we've been educating universities and monitoring and retaining the talent that they actually get to select their university, right? There's some stats that show there's certain protected groups that may fall out of the program at a faster rate than others. And so monitoring that to try and get every individual that you actually select to fulfill their entire program commitment and stay with that university. And so that's what we also see on the employment side is if you go through the effort to have all of these DEI programs and initiatives and focus on the culture of your workplace, it's really important to retain the talent in which you have as well and create more opportunities for those individuals as well too. So there's a lot of benefit to doing these DEI risk assessments, but they are pretty robust. They're not a one and done initiative. And so just some final thoughts that I have on this topic is they're not one and done, meaning you need to continuously monitor your DEI programs because there are ever-evolving local, state, and federal mandates that are happening. There's litigation cases that are going on. And then there's just other practices that evolve over time or that we learn about that are better fitted for better outcomes for the employer or the employee. And so keeping that in mind and knowing that it's not just check the box and move on, but there are ways to make this achievable in doing small chunks or trying to setting a cadence for looking at it at various parts of your organization. And then as you're rolling out new initiatives, there's opportunities to pilot on small parts of your workforce, before you advance to the entire workforce with those initiatives. And so keeping those tips and tricks in mind is important because it can't all be done overnight either.
Kelly, thank you so much for all of your advice here. I think it's really helpful. We have with DCI, Fortney Scott, a program, DEI risk assessment that we put together, which we are using with clients. And I think we cannot say strongly enough that corporations need to do this privileged assessment with all these challenges. And it's a perfect time to determine, in addition, as you mentioned, what's effective, what's working. And oh, by the way, my favorite thing is don't forget inclusion. Diversity seems to get all the credit, and don't forget inclusion. Kelly, thank you so very much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you all for joining us for today. If you haven't already subscribed, please subscribe to DC Insider Employer Update. Our podcast is on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you have your favorite podcast source. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to the DC Insider Employer Update. The podcast that provides analysis of significant federal developments affecting the workplace that employers need to understand. You can subscribe to the DC Insider Employer Update podcast wherever you get your podcasts, which includes Apple, Spotify, and Google. Additional information about our podcast is located on the Fortney Scott website at fortneyscott.com. Thanks again for listening to the DC Insider Employer Update.